Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, saguaros are threatened by climate change, but could a tiny fungus protect them?
And as soccer hopes to gain equal footing with other sports in this country, could cleats be the key?
But first, state health officials say there have been more than 7,500 cases of valley fever reported so far this year. It's transmitted when people inhale fungal spores living in the ground. The majority of this year's cases have been reported in Maricopa County. The actual number of cases, though, is likely higher because diagnosing the fungal disease can be a challenge. But researchers at ASU and Mayo Clinic are working on a new, faster way to find out if a patient has valley fever, and the result has been licensed by a company called Cactus Bio. Doug Lake joins me to talk about it. He's a professor at ASU and chair of foundational sciences at the new School of Medicine and Advanced Medical Engineering there. And Doug, what's the thought behind this new valley fever test?
So the thought behind it is to have a rapid test because currently the problem is somebody will go into an urgent care or an emergency department and they'll have a pneumonia or some sort of a respiratory infection. And the healthcare provider won't know, is it viral? Is it bacterial? Or around here, is it a fungal infection like valley fever? So oftentimes they walk away with an antibiotic because the testing for valley fever takes a long time. So it's anywhere between 3 days and 7 days really to get a result back. So we wanted to make a rapid test that would tell a healthcare provider, do you give that first dose of antibiotic? Or can you tell the patient, oh, you don't need antibiotics. Do you need other care like an antifungal?
Is this the kind of thing that a chest x-ray can't identify? Like if you're not sure if it's, for example, pneumonia or COVID or valley fever, like would a chest x-ray help identify that?
Right. So a chest x-ray is pretty much indistinguishable. So someone could have a pneumonia because of COVID. They could have a pneumonia because of a bacterial infection or even something non-infectious. So there's no way to tell. I mean, it could even look like cancer. So sometimes people our healthcare provider will say, you know, you have a nodule in your lung. Maybe you should go see an oncologist. So, and it turns out, you know, the good news is it turns out to be valley fever instead of cancer.
So it sounds like your test works kind of on the same principle as sort of the rapid COVID test that many of us became familiar with, except instead of shoving a swab up your nose, you take a blood draw?
Yeah. So that's exactly right. So our test works on a finger stick, and it also works by blood draw. So a person would go in and get normal phlebotomy, and either plasma or serum would be obtained from that tube of blood, and then just a tiny drop of blood on that test, and a few drops of chase buffer, just like we do with our COVID tests. Mm-hmm. And 10 minutes later, you know whether you have antibodies to valley fever. So we're looking for antibodies, which is indicative of an active infection.
How certain can one be of the results? Like if you have the antibodies, how certain are you that you have valley fever? And conversely, if you don't have the antibodies, how certain are you that you do not have valley fever?
Right. So the test looks for antibodies, as I mentioned. And if antibodies are present, it's very likely that and symptoms match. Mm-hmm. For example, a chest x-ray. So there's a constellation of symptoms that people might have if they have valley fever. They might have night sweats, they might have a cough, extreme fatigue. And along with those symptoms, they also might have a nodule in their chest, you know, by chest x-ray. And along with those symptoms, if they have a positive antibody test, we're in the high 90 percentile range that they actually do have valley fever. And if they're negative and they still have these symptoms, we're also in the high 90 percentile range that uh, they they don't have valley fever. They have something else.
But as you were saying, it sounds like this is not sort of the be-all, end-all. It's a big piece of the diagnosis or ruling something out, but maybe not the only component of it?
Right, exactly. So things have to match, right? So if you come in with a headache only and you do a test, you can have other symptoms that may be contributory, but a healthcare provider has to put the pieces together, and this test aids in the diagnosis of the disease.
How is this test different than the tests you mentioned earlier that could take maybe 3 to 7 days? Like, are those also looking for antibodies, or are they sort of a totally different path?
So those tests also look for antibodies, but they have to be sent so that, once again, a tube of blood would be drawn. So our test uses a finger stick, but you can also run the test with a tube of blood. So the current tests, you have to go in and get phlebotomy, and then it's sent to a central laboratory because only very skilled personnel can do those sorts of tests. They're very complicated, and only central labs do those tests.
Are yours more of like an at-home kind of thing? Like, could I do it in my kitchen like I did with COVID tests?
Right. So we're hoping we're going to get there with an at-home test. Currently, we're pursuing FDA or an FDA regulatory strategy so that we have to march through all the forms and all the FDA regulatory paperwork in order to get approval for either an at-home test or a CLIA waived test, which would be something that an urgent care department could do, for example.
Is it the going to that location that takes the time, or is there some new technology that enables the antibodies to either make themselves known or not more quickly than the test that we have now?
So the first thing is it has to be sent to a central laboratory where a laboratory professional is trained to do those sorts of tests. And the other reason is that the tests that we're currently using were developed in the 60s. And so things move faster now that we're in 2025 than they did in 1960. So the tests are just the nature of the tests are much slower. The nature of the current tests are much slower.
In the world of valley fever, how important is it to have this kind of test, do you think, where somebody can find out quickly and accurately whether or not they have it? And I ask mostly because I know that diagnosis is one of the impediments to people either getting treated or to really even knowing how prevalent this disease is.
Absolutely. So this, we hope, will really, this test, this rapid test, we hope will be a game changer for the diagnosis of valley fever, because currently even the CDC guidelines start with patients that are not responding on antibiotics. So that means they've already been misdiagnosed. So we want to avoid that first dose of antibiotic that the patient gets so that they can be properly diagnosed right away. Because as you know, you don't want to take the wrong drug. If you take the wrong drug, then it's not helping you.
Well, and you don't want to take antibiotics if you don't have to also, right?
Exactly. And so healthcare providers are excited about this because it provides an opportunity for proper antibiotic stewardship.
All right. Doug, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Sure. I'm happy to be here. Thanks.
Doug Lake is a professor at ASU and chair of foundational sciences at the new School of Medicine and Advanced Medical Engineering there.
We all know that water is our most precious resource here in the desert. And as climate change makes it hotter and drier, it's becoming even more essential. But researchers are learning a tiny fungi just might be able to help. Mycorrhizal fungi are a vital part of ecosystems around the world, including to climate-threatened saguaros here in the Sonoran Desert. And researchers are trying to find out if they could be a key in helping protect the iconic cactuses in a warmer future. Wyatt Maiskow covers the Southwest for Inside Climate News, and I spoke with him more about these hidden little fungi.
Despite you not being able to see them, mycorrhizal fungi are incredibly vital parts of ecosystems around the world, and including in the Sonoran Desert. And they form what we call symbiotic relationships with just about every type of land plant. And The way one of the researchers described them was as a highway. They exchange water and nutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus for carbon that they use to continuing to expand out this highway system that grows out their roots even further and even connects them to other species kind of across a whole ecosystem, a whole region of plants and fungi and all sorts of things. And so they're incredibly important for plants being able to get the nutrients they need, helps keep them more resilient, helps kind of stabilize them in the ground. Again, they kind of extend that root system. And they also, for climate change, they sequester over 13 billion tons of carbon. And that carbon, if it, you know, wasn't being sequestered, would otherwise go towards warming the climate further, which obviously would not be ideal for us or for those plants and, of course, the fungi themselves as well.
Right. And explain for us a little bit about how it is that this fungi works in particular for saguaros, which we know are threatened. They seem to maybe act as a lesson or some sort of way of protecting these saguaros, right?
Yeah, that's what the researchers that I worked with were trying to find out. We know that there are mycorrhizal fungi in the soils next to saguaros oftentimes. The question is just how important, though, are they? And that's what they were trying to find out. Saguaros, as we know, are struggling. You have climate change causing hotter and drier summers. You know, saguaros are really resilient creatures. They last centuries, right? You don't live that long unless you are resilient in the wild, right?
Yeah.
But climate change is really kind of throwing a wrench in that and just kind of making things harder for them to survive and to reproduce. And the hope is if we can understand how these fungi work with these saguaros, we can understand then what kind of conditions they need to support each other and recognize, okay, if we protect these soils better than we are currently, how could that maybe help saguaros, right, this iconic species, continue to thrive and live in Arizona and across the Southwest? That way we don't lose more of this iconic species.
Yeah, which is a real concern right now. So you went along with these researchers here at Saguaro National Park, as you mentioned. Tell us about what that was like. Like, how did they find this stuff in the soil? This is hidden, as you say, but they're using some kind of intense technology to figure this out.
Yeah, it's somewhat intense, but also not really. I mean, the you know, like I said, this fungi is found pretty much everywhere. And so to get the samples themselves, the researchers I was with are with the Society for the Protection of Underground Networks. They're a scientific organization, nonprofit, founded to map these fungal networks kind of around the world. And they do a ton of these trips to go to undersampled areas and collect these types of samples. They've done it here, they've done it in Kazakhstan, they've done it elsewhere.
Wow.
And they also take existing data and essentially use AI and, you know, modern technology to map out what do we know, what do we not know, where are these networks, how do they work, all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so I joined them at the park this spring in March to just spend a day with them to see how it was done. And you know, it's surprisingly simple. I mean, to collecting the samples, all they did was, you know, they went out into the field, then they took, you know, basically a metal cylinder, a rubber mallet, a plastic bag, and they, you know, found saguaros and they got on their hands and knees and, you know, hammered that metal sphere, essentially that metal cylinder, into the ground, pulled out the dirt and put it in a plastic bag. And then that bag is sent back to the research lab to be analyzed to figure out, okay, what exact fungi are in this soil and what can we learn about it? How does it maybe differ from others? How is it maybe similar? And kind of beginning to get an understanding of how this stuff works. What was interesting, though, it may be more kind of advanced technology that's a little more complex, was they had, you know, on their iPhones, you know, LiDAR technology. Essentially, they found their saguaro that they took a sample of. They wanted to get information on what kind of saguaro was this. You know, they wanted a diverse collection of samples from all different age groups, or how do these ones survive longer than ones that don't? So they're taking all these samples, but they want to collect, okay, what do these saguaros look like, right? And they could take photos, they could maybe, you know, write down in their notes what it looked like, but they use their phones and they use this LiDAR to essentially scan them. And yeah, right there on the spot, in the matter of minutes, it was creating on their phone and adding it to their database, these like 3D images of these saguaros. And it, you know, it was able to calculate, without them doing measurements themselves, how tall it was, how many arms it have, which then gives you kind of a rough estimate of how old it is.
Yeah. So this is threatened in another way, though, right? Like, researchers need basically kind of untouched soil, untouched ecosystems to do this research, right? To take those samples, to understand how this is working and how it might assist saguaros in the future. But that kind of untouched landscape is harder to find these days, especially as we're looking at massive cuts from the Trump administration, right?
Correct. You know, most people, I mean, we're all familiar with national parks. If you live in Arizona, you've been to the Grand Canyon, you've probably been to Saguaro, you've maybe been to Petrified Forest and other protected areas like national monuments. And, you know, those places have a real recreational benefit, right? For us to, you know, go and hike there, enjoy it. It also, of course, has benefits for wildlife and a little bit of an unsung use of national parks and protected areas like these is for research purposes, right?
Right.
Because they are untouched, because they are protected, you got to get a good idea of what an ecosystem looks like when it is not being disrupted by humans, essentially, right? We're not developing there, we're not building houses, we're not driving all over it. We're leaving it pretty much the way it was. But like you said, that's disappearing in the modern world generally. So these national parks and places like them are incredibly important generally for understanding what are we losing, what could be lost if we continue doing this stuff, and also just understanding what does an ecosystem look like before humans begin to mess with it. And with the Trump administration, we're already seeing, you know, mass layoffs at parks, a lot of that, you know, being kind of done in the scientific research realms of those parks. And it's going to make it harder to be able to do this type of work. And I mean, one thing to be clear, I mean, Saguaro National Park is not going to be dismantled and sold off, most likely under the current Trump administration. But it does have a lot less staff. And those staff are incredibly important for allowing these researchers to be able to come in and do this type of research and maybe be able to add to this research. I mean, some of the best saguaro experts you'll find work under the Interior Department, you know, and then that's not even getting into national monuments, which are also incredibly important for doing this type of research, but have been threatened by the Trump administration with downsizing, with dismantling. It's something they've already tried to do in the past. We know that it's going to happen again. It's just kind of a matter of when. And there's real concerns over, I mean, for many reasons, right? It's a place that people can no longer go to and recreate. It means that, you know, a great wildlife corridor no longer exists, but it also means that research like this to study something that we really don't know much about disappears. As you know, one of the researchers told me, once it's gone and deleted, it's gone. And the thing that upset him, and this is quoting him, if they're gone before we actually know what's there, we have no idea what we lost. And that's really important. And one thing I'll stress here too on this is when we talk about climate change, you know, it's often an assumption, and it's a true assumption, that fossil fuels are obviously a major driver of our climate crisis. But another kind of unsung factor that gets less attention is the loss of biodiversity. You know, species like these fungi and the species they then kind of in turn help grow and support are incredibly important for sequestering carbon, for creating healthy ecosystems that in turn make our planet a healthier place.
Yeah. All right. We'll leave it there for now. That is Wyatt Mieskow, Southwest correspondent based here in Phoenix for Inside Climate News. Wyatt, thanks for coming on and telling us about this. I appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you so much.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, wearing soccer cleats off the field. We'll hear about the latest footwear trend known as Boots Only Summer.
But first, summers in Phoenix are notoriously scorching, and now they're stretching into the fall. Last summer, we went nearly 4 months straight without seeing high temperatures even dip into the double digits. So this summer, we're taking a deeper look at something that can help us mitigate that torturous heat, shade. From planting trees to building structures, we're trying to figure out how we can live more comfortably in these intense conditions, and we are calling this series Throwing Shade.
Today, let's talk about shade structures, but not just any shade structures. Let's talk about public art and turning it into functioning shade. In another hot city not too far from here, they're calling it beautiful shade. Palm Springs City Council approved its first public art slash shade structure, and the path to approve it was revealing. How do you create shade and art? Phoenix has tried to do it, so have lots of other cities around the country. I spoke with Palm Springs Post reporter Kendra Balchin about how it went down in her city.
Palm Springs had 83 days last year where the temperature hit at least 110 degrees, and 6 days were over 120 degrees.
Wow.
So, yeah, a very urgent need for more shade, really in whatever form it takes. And this idea of beautiful shade came forward, I think, about 2 years ago. That's when the Public Arts Commission for Palm Springs started pursuing the idea. And the goal was to create attractive public art that is also functional and provides some much needed shade. And the commission's thinking is that public art and what a city chooses to display is really a statement of values. And making these designs both attractive and functional makes a statement that the city is invested in protecting folks from the sun and also keeping the city attractive.
So, I mean, obviously, we are familiar here in Phoenix with incredibly hot temperatures. But,
yes.
But Palm Springs is a little different. It's smaller and it's such a tourism town, right? Like, does the heat and the increasing heat there, is it affecting tourism?
Yeah, absolutely. I was born and raised here, and I remember summers decades ago where you say you could roll a bowling ball down Main Street. There were no cars. It absolutely, it's a resort town. So the town would shut up during the summer, restaurants would close, and it was really vacant. But come COVID, people even started to visit during the summer. But again, that's kind of dwindling down as people remember how hot it gets in Palm Springs. So definitely part of the motivation for the city is not just the residents, but also keeping the temperature comfortable for our poor visitors, especially from Canada, who definitely are not used to this heat.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, so trying to create this idea of public art and shade, we've seen this happen in other cities around the country. Mm-hmm. There have been attempts at it here in Phoenix as well, some temporary projects that are in the works now. But there's a lot to consider. Tell us a little bit about the discussions in Palm Springs as this kind of idea came about a few years ago, as you mentioned. I mean, Palm Springs is an artsy town, right?
Totally. Yeah. And aesthetics are extremely important to the city in architecture, in art, in all things. So that's why it took so many years to get this project kind of going. So part of the consideration was, of course, aesthetics. And that's why one of the projects that was selected, it's called Parkside Gossip, which evokes Slim Aaron's iconic Palm Springs photograph, Poolside Gossip, with these yellow and white umbrellas that also kind of look like flowers. So that was a huge consideration. And also it being effective and not, you know, being taken down by the wind or being able to be graffitied really easily or kids clambering on it. So all of those usual considerations, as well as scalability, they were discussing once we get these built come October of this year, once they're built, can we scale them up? Can we scale them down to put, you know, a little version of Parkside Gossip maybe over a water fountain in a park versus a big 13-foot tall sculpture?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So what else has Palm Springs considered along these lines? Like, art is a really interesting way to look at it. But I mean, have they tried trees, sails, things like that? I mean, as it's getting hotter, we're all thinking about these things, right?
Yeah. So those shade canopies and sails have been installed mostly over the city's playground equipment, of course, so our kids don't get third-degree burns from metal playground equipment. And then the question of trees comes up a lot when folks hear about these alternative shade structures. People wonder, why spend so much money and time fabricating something when nature has provided us with the perfect shade structure in the form of a tree? And it has the benefit of reducing CO2. So why bother with all of this? And it sounds great. And honestly, it's kind of what I thought before I learned more. But as soon as you dig a little deeper, you learn how tree roots interact with underground infrastructure like power and water and sewer, in addition to the water that's used to keep all of those trees alive. So this engineered shade is definitely in the toolkit of the city and other cities, of course, like Phoenix, to keep things cool.
Interesting. So talk a little bit about the selection process and this project that was chosen. Describe it for us.
Yeah, it was really rigorous. It was, you know, enjoyable to watch as much as commission meetings can be enjoyable. I think there were something like definitely over 20 submissions, and a lot of them were nature-based, and the commission was deciding both on aesthetics and how effective is this shade. Mm-hmm. They really liked this one. It was, I think, a couple condors kind of in a circle. So it looked like they were circling above you. Huh. And they really liked it, but they thought that it didn't really offer enough shade. So that was
right.
Struck from the list. Yeah. So, and there was a robust discussion of aesthetics and give and take of what's attractive versus what's not attractive. But they were almost unanimous on this one from the very, very beginning with the yellow and white umbrellas and the nod to Poolside Gossip. So that was an easy pick for them. And then the second decision, it's called Dragonfly Bench. So that is basically going to have three little seats, and dragonfly wings will provide the shade. And it's just very whimsical. And you can just see kids being drawn towards it, hopefully not climb it, but being drawn towards it in an attractive, colorful way.
Yeah. So broadly there, Kendall, you said you're born and raised in Palm Springs. How has the increasing heat changed life there?
I think people just become more insular, and the world just starts to shrink to your house, your apartment, that little bit of time that you walk to your car and your skin feels like it's frying, and then the walk to your workplace or grocery store. And the town just kind of comes alive once the sun sets. It's still hot. It's well over 100 degrees. You can still feel the heat radiating from the ground, but at least you can go outside without your skin frying. So I think that it's just kind of shrunk people's lives, and they feel like they have to lock everything down just to be safe.
Yeah, we can definitely relate to that here.
Yeah.
So this is the inaugural Shade Public Art Project there in Palm Springs, and it's not up yet. But as I mentioned, we're seeing kind of similar ideas of combining shade and functionality with public art and with aesthetics in other parts of the country and of the world. What are you hearing from the public in response to this? Like, is this something that seems like it will be scaled up? As you said, it may be able to be.
Yeah, the commission and the city council are both super excited by these designs and the idea of scalability. And like I said, when something like these alternative shade structures gets introduced, the first comment on Facebook is always, why not trees? So that's kind of the initial gut reaction that people have. But Palm Springs is such an artistic city, and we have so much public art already that having new pieces that are colorful, that nod to the city's mid-century modern aesthetics and are also functional, I think people are going to be really excited.
All right, we'll leave it there. Kendall Balchin, journalist with the Palm Springs Post, joining us to talk more about shade solutions in that city. Kendall, thanks for coming on. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Neuroscientist Lior Zmigrod has a saying, demography is not destiny. She came up with it to counter what she says is a misconception, that people's ideologies are shaped by their cultural identities. Zmigrod's research suggests otherwise, that the biological makeup of the human brain makes it uniquely susceptible to ideological suggestion. The better we understand that, she says, the better we can understand how and why so many are compelled by extremist political movements. Zmigrod explains the science behind all this in her new book, The Ideological Brain, and she spoke recently about it with our co-host Sam Dingman.
It tries to understand the world, to predict the world, to understand the past, the present, and the future, right? Because that's the way in which we can be successful in living in the world. We want a kind of accurate representation of the reality which we navigate. And that is a property of the brain that makes us incredibly intelligent, incredibly successful as a species. But it can also lead to a temptation for narratives that explain the world for us. And so that's why there's a kind of magnetism between what our brains typically do when they're at their best and what ideologies satisfy and what they offer in return, which are these really compelling narratives about the world. But the problem is that those narratives can lead us astray in many ways, and they can even change the bodies of the believers in ways that can sometimes be toxic.
Yes, and this strikes me as this really important subtlety, which is that it's not that certain people, based on what kind of government they live under or where in the world they are, what race or gender they are, or whatever, are predisposed to ideology. It's that the brain and ideology have this magnetic relationship.
Exactly. And so we can understand why all of us can be really prone to embracing ideologies to a kind of passionate degree. But by looking at the brains of people who are highly dogmatic and highly ideological, I've been also able to see, well, which people, which kinds of brains are the most likely to run towards an ideology when it comes around, you know, and to embrace it in the most extreme and passionate way.
And if I'm not mistaken here, what you're referring to is this notion of cognitive flexibility, right?
Yeah. So a lot of my research has looked at this trait called cognitive flexibility, or on the other side of the spectrum, cognitive rigidity. And one kind of test that I use to measure this is called the Wisconsin card sorting test, where people are sorting cards according to a rule, which they gradually learn. So they gradually learn that when they match a red card with another red card, they'll get a really satisfying positive response from the game and they'll get points. And so they start kind of matching cards according to their color, a blue card with a blue card, a green card with a green card. And so they're playing the game. They figured out this rule. They're applying this habit. And then without the participants knowing, the rule of the game changes. And some of us, when we encounter evidence that maybe we should change our behavior and look for a new rule, we'll adapt, right? We will look and say, well, actually, maybe I should match the cards according to the shape, like, you know, put stars with stars and cards that have squares with other cards that have squares. And we'll figure out a new rule and change our behavior. But other people, when they encounter the change, they will really resist. And they'll actually apply the old color rule again, even though all the evidence suggests that they should change their behavior.
Right.
And those are the most cognitively rigid people. And what's interesting, as you can tell, this task, this game has nothing to do with politics,
right?
At all, right? It's just a game. But the way people play this game really predicts their ideologies.
And if I'm not mistaken, you found that the more cognitively rigid someone is, the more likely they are to resonate with an extreme political point of view, which might seem obvious, but there's some nuance there, right?
Exactly. Because one of the almost surprising findings is that actually people who tend to be on the far right and on the far left are both characterized by this cognitive rigidity. So they're actually maybe more similar than they'd like to admit from a psychological perspective, you know?
I'm sure they would hate to hear that.
They might hate to hear that.
Now, Lior, earlier, you also talked about how ideology can have these more physical effects.
Yeah. So one of the amazing things we're discovering through this new field called political neuroscience is how the biology of our brains, the biology of our nervous system, can also relate to how extremely we adopt an ideology or which kind of ideology we most gravitate towards. So, for instance, one of the findings that we're seeing repeatedly across hundreds of people in multiple countries is that people who tend to have right-wing beliefs and ideologies tend to have a part of the brain called the amygdala. It tends to be enlarged. And what the amygdala is responsible for is it's responsible for our processing of negative emotions like threat, fear, disgust of things that are foreign. And so there's this sense that maybe having this neurobiological disposition where you have a larger amygdala that tends to process and engage with those negative emotions, that could potentially lead you to be more likely to adopt a right-wing ideology that perhaps also tends to echo those emotions in some of its rhetoric.
Yes, and this seems like another really important, delicate element of your research, which is that we don't yet know if politics impacts psychology or the other way around. But what we do seem to know is that what you call the resource environment in which the brain experiences ideologies is critical here.
That's right. So I can give an example of one study that looked at this. In this experiment, they looked at how much people are willing to share a little pot of money, of $10 that they have, with the faces of random strangers. And for some of these participants, they made them feel like, oh, they only have $10. That's really not that much. And for other people, they made them feel like, oh my gosh, $10, that's a ton of money that you can share. And when they were then invited to share that little pot of money with other strangers, with the faces of strangers, they saw that when people were in a condition where they felt that there wasn't enough to go around, their decisions about who to share their money with became more racially discriminatory. And broadly, what we take away from this is that being in an environment, and potentially in the political environment, where it feels like there's not enough resources going around, that kind of brings out the most discriminatory in us, even without our knowledge.
And this makes me think of a scrambling factor when we think of the resource environment, which is the internet.
Absolutely. When you think about what happens when you put brains that have all these psychological, even neurobiological sensitivities to taking an ideology to the extreme, and you put them on social media, which is an information environment designed to give them the most binary information, to give them the most, you know, the information that just confirms their beliefs, that doesn't challenge their beliefs, and information that's really emotionally negative, right? To make you feel threatened, to make you feel like there isn't enough to go around for your tribe or your group, you're really putting potentially very vulnerable minds in a very radicalizing environment.
Yeah. And I feel like you're also helping me understand something important here, Lior, which I think sometimes gets lost in these conversations when we think about social media, which is that what the social media company in question in the example you just gave is doing is not necessarily endorsing one particular ideology over another, but rather reacting to the same neurological phenomenon that political ideologies react to, which is the brain's desire to find and then keep and predict future sources of order and identity.
Absolutely. And recognizing that, understanding how these ideological and digital settings really exploit our greatest vulnerabilities, I think that although that sounds quite negative, I think it can be quite empowering because we have a better understanding of how these processes are working on and through us and what we can do about it.
Well, Lior Zmigrod is a neuroscientist and the author of the book, The Ideological Brain, The Radical Science of Flexible Thinking. Lior, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. We are in the midst of, it seems, something called Boots Only Summer. It is the trend that started, as so many of them seem to these days, on TikTok. It involves people wearing soccer cleats or boots in places that are definitely not soccer fields. The U.S. did recently host two international soccer tournaments, the Gold Cup and the Club World Cup, and will host FIFA's World Cup next year along with Mexico and Canada. So is Boots Only Summer a sign that soccer is taking off in this country? Or maybe it says something about the state of footwear fashion? With me to discuss is Luis Torres, Partnerships and Social Media Manager at Rejuvenator. And Luis, let's start our terms, define our terms at the outset here. What exactly is Boots Only Summer?
So it kind of started as a meme and it's taken over, especially with Gen Z. But essentially, it started because of the price of cleats being upwards of $250, sometimes even $300.
Like soccer cleats.
Soccer cleats, yeah. People just wearing them because they're luxury or because, you know, they're just at a high price point. So it kind of started off as just, let's mix things up. Let's get away from the chunky silhouettes and stuff and try something new, especially because it's so Y2K centered. And that's kind of where I feel like trends are kind of going back to right now. So it was just a little bit of everything.
Now, I've got to ask, because I was around for Y2K in my adulthood, and I don't remember anybody wearing soccer cleats not on a soccer field.
Well, definitely not that. That definitely wasn't part of the Y2K. I think it's a little bit more reformatted, if anything, because, you know, the peak of soccer, the culture, the kits, all that was very, you know, kind of Y2K. But now it's just kind of a more Gen Z's approach to what it could have been with social media and all that.
So does this trend represent an increase in interest in soccer in the U.S., do you think?
I would hope. I mean, especially with the World Cup being here in 2026,
yeah.
You know, you really want that to happen. And as a soccer fan, I hope this is kind of a shift in the interest in the sport. But if anything, I think the fashion aspect of football, soccer has always kind of been there. And especially in the last few years, we've seen fashion houses from Dior to Louis Vuitton, kind of integrating soccer and the vibe into their collections. And we're going to see it more from Nike. I mean, they're reissuing a lot of old stuff and some of the other brands, Adidas primarily too. So we'll see more of it.
It seems like at least in the U.S. in the past, for sports that have had footwear sort of integrated into pop culture, it's mostly, I think, been basketball. Is that fair to say? Like, is this really sort of moving in on that territory?
Yeah, I mean, you know, especially basketball, like, you know, a court and the concrete, it's not too much in terms of a surface. A boot obviously is very much different with the studs and the material. So, and again, I think just the U.S. culturally, basketball has always kind of been at the forefront. Baseball doesn't really have much of footwear DNA, so that's really hasn't translated. So yeah, hopefully this is kind of the next step in where footwear is going and can go.
All right, so a couple logistical questions here. Number one, if you wear soccer cleats on a sidewalk or on a street, the cleats get worn down.
Yeah.
Number two, a lot of them aren't all that comfortable if you're not on grass. So how are shoe manufacturers trying to work around those things?
I don't think they are. I mean, obviously, especially because if we're talking just production of shoe lines, right, like a shoe from concept to ideation to all that, it takes like around 12 to 18 months to go to market. So by the time, you know, they're seeing that first boots trend summer, it's already 6 months in. And by the time it goes out to production, it's like, well, there's no point. So because there are different types of studs or cleats.
Yeah.
So there's like artificial ground and firm ground and soft. And then there's indoor versions, which are completely, you know, spikeless. So it's really just on the consumer, like what's more comfortable for them. But I don't see the brand is doing anything because, again, you're just – at that point, you're stripping it away from its actual function. And if anything, you know, specifically the Gazelle and the Samba, those are soccer shoes, and they just kind of, you know, went with a different bottom. But that's how it started and kind of got adapted. So we'll see more of that, I'm sure.
Well, and those two shoes have been around for a very long time, like the Samba especially. I remember kids when I was in junior high and high school wearing those as their sort of day-to-day sneakers, their PE shoes, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So is this like a, in some ways, a nostalgia kind of thing or a nostalgia by people who maybe weren't around the first time?
Yeah, I think, like I said, you know, that Y2K, especially with so much of the social and buying power being with Gen Z, I think even myself, right? Like I, born in 98, I very much love that purple and teal from the Diamondbacks, even though I was very, very, I mean, I was born when the franchise started, you know? So people always love nostalgia. The brands know it. And yeah, this is probably just more of the same. It's just in a different lens.
All right, so I got to ask you about the box of shoes that you brought. Can you tell me a little bit about what this is I'm looking at?
Yeah, so this is the Total 93. Essentially, this was released in the early 2000s by Nike. It was originally a cleat worn by a lot of like the Nike greats, Wayne Rooney, Figo, Roberto Carlos, a lot of great players. And this was at the peak of Nike's soccer marketing with I could go on and nerd out for hours on it, but this was really, really the pinnacle of an era for Nike soccer. And so in the last few years, Adidas has really been dominating with the Samba and the Gazelle and a lot of those sleeker indoor adapted shoes. So this was Nike's response. Still the same upper colorways. This is one of the original colorways that dropped back in the early 2000s.
It's a silver with a black swoosh.
Yeah, silver patent leather. I mean, you know, it's kind of like someone joked with me, it looks like, you know, jazz or like ballerina shoes. But, you know, the Total 90, that's supposed to represent, you know, 90 minutes on the pitch.
Yeah.
So it's geared towards, you know, just the longevity of a match, of a game of high performance. So, but yeah, now it's kind of more streetwear.
Does this trend say anything to you about even people who aren't necessarily wearing soccer cleats off of a soccer pitch? Mm-hmm. Does this say anything about the kinds of sneakers or the kinds of shoes people are looking to be wearing now more broadly?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen it all the time, right? Like Jordans being worn by people that don't play basketball, right? And I think we're seeing the same thing. Granted, the actual function and makeup of the shoe is drastically different. We are going to see, you know, just more people adopt soccer and jerseys and the culture as a whole without really having an emotional tie to it. It just looks cool.
Do you see this as sort of an extension of other fashion nostalgia trends we've seen? Like, I think back to a few years ago when Mad Men was a very popular TV show and everybody's wearing those, you know, 1960s suits with the skinny ties and the skinny lapels. Like, is this in some ways kind of an extension of that?
Yeah. I mean, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. That's kind of how I see it. And footwear and fashion is no exception. I think a lot of, even just some of the most fashion forward pieces and things are still remnants and call outs of the past. It's just how much of that do you know? So, I think it's just one of those things where we're always going to see fashion and footwear kind of call back to the past, because especially with Adidas and Nike primarily being so ingrained in sport and heritage, it's hard to stray away from that and still have a top selling product.
Do you think this boots only summer is sustainable enough to make it two summers? And you referenced, you know, the World Cup coming. Like, will this still be a thing next year when, you know, soccer teams from around the world are descending on North America?
I don't think the boots on itself will be a thing, but I do see football, soccer culture integrating itself more and more. And I think the brands are aware of that. While, you know, Adidas and Nike are still going to continue to push out their boots. They know we have to make streetwear adjacent jerseys and apparel because that's more for the mainstream consumer that, you know, because again, I mean, Nike's been reissuing T90 jerseys from old club or old clubs and old national teams that they used to sponsor, but they're doing it without the actual sponsorship. Mm. So like Mexico is now with Adidas. They reissued a Mexico T90 jersey, $90, which is way more inexpensive than a $350 cleat, right? So there are ways where they're trying to make it a little bit more attainable to the everyday consumer, but the cleats themselves are going to save that price point because at the end of it, it's still about function and performance, and they're not going to stray away from that.
All right. That is Luis Torres, Partnerships and Social Media Manager for Rejuvenator. Luis, thanks for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Of course. Always happy to be here.
You're a good soldier, choosing your battle. Pick yourself up and dust yourself off and back in the saddle. You're on the front line. Everyone's watching.
Gonna have to go get myself some boots, Mark. I'm into it. And this song.
Yes.
All right, that'll do it for this edition of the show. We will, of course, be back with you again tomorrow with much more. Remember, you can sign up for the show's weekly newsletter, Radio Heads. It is at theshow.kjzz.org.
For Lauren Gilger and Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a great rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.